Welcome to Changing Academic Life. I'm Geraldine Fitzpatrick, and this is a podcast series where academics and others share their stories, provide ideas, and provoke discussions about what we can do individually and collectively to change academic life for the better.
I think you'll really love today's conversation with Christian van Nieuwenberg. He's a professor of coaching and positive psychology at the Centre for Positive Health Sciences at the Royal College of Surgeons, Ireland, University of Medicine and Health Sciences. He's also a practitioner providing coach training and consultancy for the education sector. As full disclosure, Christian was one of my lecturers when I did my Masters of Positive Psychology and Coaching Psychology at UEL, and he was the lecturer for our coaching modules. I wanted to talk to Christian, triggered by a few of the themes that we've been hearing lately. First of all, it was Susan Dre talking about deep listening, and Christian had just released a book, coincidentally, called Radical Listening that we mention here. It was also the last discussions with Jen and Bethany and Jane that highlighted issues around good leadership practices, good supervision practices, and also the importance of looking after our own well-being, and as well as being intentional. So these are all themes that you will hear in this conversation. So Christian's webpage is called Coach on a Motorcycle, and this is a very deliberate choice of branding that came about with him trying to align all parts of his work and his life as a pracademic to foster his own well-being. He argues that our universities should be places of joy. They should be joyful, safe, inclusive places where students and staff can flourish, and despite the constraints like performance metrics and burnout. He talks about the ways in which well-being is really foundational for us to be able to do good work, about how a coaching approach can be really ideal for setting up learning environments, for building autonomy and self-efficacy and connection. And he also talks about the importance of intention. Intention, he says, is central to how we show up, because intention directs attention. And this is the way in which we can really help others feel seen, valued, and heard. And throughout, Christian also provides lots of practical suggestions for how to check in with our own intentions and our choices, reminding us that we have more agency than we think. Also, just to briefly forewarn, there are a couple of occasional spots where Christian's audio drops out, but it's not for very long, and I don't think it impacts the understandability of what he was saying. So, welcome, Christian. I've really been looking forward to this conversation for a long time. Your webpage has this wonderful name of Coach on a Motorcycle, and the banner on the webpage talks about creating positive environments for thriving. And I'm just curious, within your academic role, like if we turn the spotlight back onto you, on your own practices and how you apply the things that you are teaching and researching into your own work, what are some of the key ways that you're doing that, do you think, right now?
Thank you, Geraldine. What a wonderful perspective to take. You know, I've always loved academia, Geraldine. I've loved the idea of it. And when I was at university, I really was an avid learner. I just loved learning. And for me, university was a place of learning and joy and possibility. And I do remember as a student walking around and saying, one day I'd love to be an academic. I'd love to be one of those people who's creating these beautiful environments. So I've always wanted to do that. I've always wanted to work in this environment. And it's something I've always wished for. And then getting into academia, it might be a time thing. It was a different era. I found that it wasn't the way I had imagined it to be. And maybe it never was. Maybe it never was the way I'd imagined. But it was not as exhilarating as I thought it would be. There were so many constraints and challenges within the university sector. And so, yeah, my academic career is interesting. I think I was pretty late into academia. I got my PhD fairly late. And then I went straight into teaching coaching, which is my area of interest. And this coach on a motorcycle idea that emerged while I was working in academia, because I thought what's happened to me is I kind of split my life into the academic role and then my personal interests. And that was never my initial plan. My initial plan was really to flourish and to be really, thriving in an academic context. But maybe I found that difficult. And so my decision was to become a part-time academic and do my own work part-time. And somebody coined the term pracademic, which I quite like, focus on practice, also an academic. And I've grown to realize that this actually is better for me in terms of my own well-being, better for my students and my colleagues as well. And it's better for the people that I work with in terms of as a practitioner. So for me, Coach on a Motorcycle is my attempt to say, well, this is who I am. I'm a coach. I love motorcycling. And my passion is creating ideal environments for learning, for thriving, or for flourishing. And for me, those things kind of overlap. And ideally, Geraldine, my dream is that universities are beacons or examples, organizations that are places of learning in which people are flourishing.
Whoa, what an aspirational goal. And it feels like we're so far away from that right now. When you look at a lot of the research coming out on levels of burnout, when you look at the performance metrics driven aspects of how we're evaluated, and how do you navigate those tensions in having that as an aspiration?
Yeah. I'm very naive, Geraldine, and I'm never going to give up on that aspiration. That is my dream. It's always my dream. And I think maybe within my classroom, I can create that environment, maybe within my team. So I'm always hoping, how can we create that?
Yeah.
This idea of ideal environments for learning, that connects to my interest in coaching. So coaching for me is an ideal environment for learning to take place. Now, what does that mean? Well, what happens in coaching is that the client has autonomy. They have choices. They build their self-efficacy and their self-confidence. So we want that happening in universities for all of our students and academics. But the reason that happens is because the coach brings a particular way of valuing, seeing, acknowledging others. So for me, I think it's possible. And I am curious about why those statistics are the way. Book From Surviving to Thriving, A Student's Guide to Doing Well at University, that emerged with conversations with my colleague, Dr. Paige Williams at University of Melbourne. I was out there delivering some teaching. I think we were having a coffee during one of the breaks. And I think I said something to Paige like, what's happened to joy?
And who walks a
joy in higher education? What's happened to this idea that academics are going into university because they're passionate whatever it is they're researching, they want to share this with others. What's happened to the joy of students? Where have we turned to? It's all about trying to minimize damage to students. It's all about trying to protect them from something. I'm like, wait a minute, that's not the primary thing. We shouldn't be protecting people in universities. Primarily, it should be a joyful space. Now, of course, it has to be joyful. It has to be safe. It has to be inclusive. It has to be all of those things. And these things are possible. Now, where have things gone wrong? I don't know. There's so many people within the higher education sector who would probably be able to answer that. But with a few colleagues, Geraldine, at the Open University, we actually wrote an article called Bringing Joy Back into Higher Education. It's in the International Journal of Mentoring and Coaching in Education. And for me, it was us three academics, almost a little cry for help is too strong a term, but it was just even using the word, Geraldine, joy.
Yes.
Gets a reaction in a higher education setting. Some people think it's fanciful. What are you even talking about? We've got big problems right now. But others, it just sparks that reminder of, and this is a coaching question, Geraldine. You know this question. It's what got you into this in the first place?
Yeah.
Right. Ask academics that question. I want to ask vice chancellors that question. I want to ask students that question. What is it about university that really attracted you to want to be part of this? For me, it's not only a joyful enterprise, it's a noble enterprise.
Yeah.
And like I said, when I was in university, I thought, as a student, I thought that's the best job in the world.
Yeah. The joy, when you said it, it just brought a smile to my face. And it connects to some of the things that we talk about a lot from positive psychology around working from your strengths and having a sense of what gives you meaning in your work. And it seems like that joyful in terms of why you got into this in the first place connects to that.
Yeah. And for your listeners, Geraldine, what I want for them is for them to be joyful. In fact, right now, I'm in the final stages of co-authoring a book that brings together coaching, positive psychology, and Buddhism. And the book is going to be called The Lotus of Thriving. And one of the conclusions of the book is this idea of more people engaging in joyful effort. Joyful effort is that phrase. And I think joyful effort, let's think in the university context, joyful effort from an academic is good for the academic and it's good for their students. Joyful effort for university leaders is good for them. It's good for the people that they lead. So this idea of joyful effort comes up. And connecting to what you said about people experiencing joy and the meaning and purpose, my suggestion to listeners is just to check in with their own meaning and purpose. If you do work in a university or you're connected to a university in some way, what is your meaning and purpose? And let's go back to that initial question. What got you into this in the first place? And then, as a kind of a self-awareness tool, maybe to look at a typical week. Look at a typical week in your calendar and then do a comparison. How much of our time in any given day is towards that meaning and purpose? And how much is other things? And coming back to that earlier question, Geraldine, about what's gone wrong, for me, there's some kind of ideal ratio. There is the other stuff to do. I have no doubts about that. We live in the real world.
Yes.
But it's probably the question of balance. Is the other stuff squeezing out the stuff that gives us that purpose and energy, or hopefully is the stuff that gives us meaning and energy the majority of our time? And when I think about this, Geraldine, this question of energy comes up. So to do the work that we do in university, energy is required. We need energy, and that applies to everybody in the system. That's the students. Students who are low energy aren't going to perform as well. They're not going to engage as much. Energy for academics, it's the same thing. And so there's one component of this is the importance of looking after our well-being so that we've got the energy that we need. The other is engaging in activities that recharge us. So therefore, the coach on a motorcycle thing for me. And then the third is, I think, a really interesting one. For me, this is like a hybrid engine which charges itself, is when we're doing work that is inherently energizing for us. So again, another way of looking at the calendar is looking through the calendar and saying, how many of these activities take my energy? How many of them give me energy? And that's also a good way to look at how we're spending our time every week. Mm,
yeah. Marcus Buckingham and a co-author have a lovely phrase about love-loathe imbalance, which I think points to that energy piece, because we often talk about work-life balance, which is a term I don't like. But yeah. I love that thing about, just to reiterate, the looking after your own well-being, because if you don't look after your well-being, you don't have anything to bring to the contributions that you want to make, to why you're there in the first place. And then there's the piece about activities that recharge. So that's about giving ourselves permission to step away from the desk, to step away from needing to write that paper or that grant or mark that assessment work, and recognize that we're going to come back to it more energized if we do step away. And then there's the last piece was...
It was actually doing things that are just recharging for us as well, like the passion things.
Yes.
It might be fishing for somebody. It might be going for long walks. For me, it's motorcycling.
Yeah.
So it's building that into my, building it back. Remember, I said there was a point where I split them and I thought, you know, being an academic is a serious business. You've got to be serious. And that's the messages we keep getting from we're a university guy. It's a serious business. You have to be serious. And so I split them out. I thought, okay, I'll be very serious at work and then I'll have my fun separately. But because work increases and increases, I was finding that I had no time for the things that I knew energized me. And that's another point, Geraldine. Everybody listening to this, everybody knows the things that they need to do for their well-being. And so, for example, you're in the midst of a long day and you're thinking, I just need to power through till 5 o'clock. Otherwise, I'm not going to get through everything.
No.
There's probably a flicker of recognition in that moment that I probably need a break right now. Even if it's 10 minutes, stand up, walk outside. That's the important moment, Geraldine. That's a moment of choice. And I think often we think, no, this is serious. I better get this done. I don't have time to look after my well-being. And if we were to even phrase it in that way, then I think we'd take a moment to reconsider, because we're saying we don't have time to look after our well-being. And that's concerning. We've got to that point.
And that's saying indirectly, by implication or by consequence, I don't have time to look after the quality of my work.
Yeah, and that's a beautiful point. So one of my professional roles through Coach on a Motorcycle, I deliver consultancy and other work, and I'm invited into organizations. And one thing I've noticed, it's attractive to have a rationale for why it's important for employees to look after their well-being. And there's a lot of evidence to support this, Geraldine. It's a strong case to say, you know, you're better off if your people are well, There's going to be less absence. There's going to be less burnout. A lot of evidence. And yet, I also hope that we can see it as a good end point in itself. It's a kind of, it's something worthy of pursuing as an end in its own right. So the well-being of our people, and remember, my dream about universities, well, certainly then the university should be highly interested in the well-being of its staff, its people, its community. That should be one of the highest priorities. And I find it interesting that we have to make a business case for, if you look after your people, then you're going to get better results. And a funny, ironic scenario I was with when I was talking to a decision maker in an organization was they were saying, oh, so Christian, you're telling me if I look after the people in this organization, they're going to perform better. And I kind of hesitated a little bit. I was like, what am I saying? Because I think if we're doing it with that purpose, if we're saying we're going to look after our people so we can get the most out of them. And you know, that term human resources is a complex term. If we think of people as a resource and we want to get the most out of the resource, then yes, you should look after that resource. But I think we're going to get even more if the resource, the human being there, actually feels the organization cares about them and their well-being. You know, this idea, Geraldine, of the extra mile, or the phrase discretionary effort, that's exactly what it is, discretionary. Every human being has the discretion to say, I'm going to go above and beyond to make sure that this class really engages with this topic. It's a choice. It's going beyond a person's contract. So I think that's my argument, is not in terms of thinking of people as resources, but my naive argument is that if we were just to show people we care about them, including students and faculty and leaders, they're going to live better lives, and therefore the families around them are going to live better lives. But then we're going to have a community that creates the environment we talked about. And as I said before, I think the university should be, in my ideal world, the kind of place that large corporations are going to say, can you explain to me, how have you gotten everybody so motivated? How come people are so engaged and really giving of what it is? And how come they're so open to feedback? And how come they're so prepared to support one another? So I'm seeing it as an opportunity to kind of reimagine universities as, what if they were kind of exemplars of organizations which are designed to allow people to really thrive.
Yeah. And I love that care at the heart of it. And that's a really interesting balance. I find the same tension in trying to communicate this because it can sound instrumental. You care for your people so you get more out of them, you know, or you get more papers or you get higher student evaluations. And you talk about this in one of your books. It's not that that's your goal. It's like the happy consequence, you know, sort of side effect of the care, which is a really subtle but important distinction to make. And that connects to something that runs as a red thread through a lot of your work as well, which is the importance of intention.
Well, Geraldine, I really appreciate you finding a red thread because, I think I've been trying to do that. And I've been asking myself, why am I writing these books that I'm writing? What is the thing that connects them? And maybe there is some kind of red thread. It helps me understand the future books that I'm writing. And intention. That's emerged, Geraldine. That wasn't there at the start. At the start, I really thought of coaching as an intervention. I thought, well, here's a very practical way of supporting people to set and achieve their goals. And that's already useful because it's a mechanism. Somebody has a goal, we help them to achieve it. But as I was working on that, I had this theory that there's three things needed to be an effective coach. You need skill, you need a conversational framework, and you need this way of being. But the more I worked on this idea and the more I talked about it, the more I learned about it, it became clear to me that the big differentiating factor was that way of being. In other words, how do we show up as a human being? And then if we're interested in how do people show up, and I'm talking again about students, academics, support staff, leaders, how do they show up? I think two things become really important. One is their well-being. So if you're not well, you're not going to show up. If you're running on empty, you're not going to have a lot to give others. So that has a big part. But then the other big factor is intention. That has a big impact on how we show up. So, and here's an opportunity for every interaction that we have every day is just to check in. What is my intention for this? And I'm not saying we have to be intentional in every activity we do. That's not reasonable. That would take up too much energy. But for those relationships or interactions that are important to us, it makes sense for me to say, well, what is my intention for this next interaction? And in that book, Radical Listening, Ms. Christina and I, we came up with it that intention then direct attention. So if my intention in an interaction is to appreciate someone or appreciate a group, then my attention is going to be drawn to things that I can appreciate. So often I get to teach in different universities around the world. And one of my intentions, the first time I meet the group of students, is to appreciate and acknowledge. That's an intention I take in. And so for the first hour or so, I'm thinking, what can I do to acknowledge and appreciate this group of people? So I would pick that up, and then I would bring it into the session in some way so that they feel, here's the key thing, they feel seen, valued, and heard. And I think if I'm able to convey that, that I'm not just a visiting academic, I'm in here to do my half-day session, then I'll be gone later. Because if I were the student and that was my academic, I would be disengaged as well. I'd be like, they're here for a few hours, they're going to be gone. So the subtitle of Radical Listening actually is The Art of True Connection.
I was just going to point to that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think we're, as human beings, we require human connection. We need human connection. So coming back to our earlier thing about if we are in universities now, and I do want to acknowledge that it can seem bleak. It can seem like a huge time of change. And I think it's reasonable to wonder whether universities are reimagining themselves quickly enough to continue to provide what they've always provided or the value that they've provided. I mean, if that's the case and you work in a university context, I think that's where we can start. We can start with connection with those around us. And we can start with, I'm going to be challenging on purpose. We can start with prioritizing our own well-being. You know, prioritizing our well-being. You know, you've been working all day to finish a project that needs to be submitted the next morning. Well, your well-being is more important. That thing can probably wait. Because if we don't do that, we're all running on empty. And then we're creating an environment in our universities where it seems to be not enough resource, not enough time. And that becomes our reality.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, that sort of care, connection. And you've also been pointing to at different times the agency that we all have to make those choices. You talked about those moments of choices in the individual moments, but also in the more intentional, how we show up in our everyday interactions. Could we focus in a little bit more just in the relationship that we might have in the one-on-one conversations with, I don't know, like our PhD students or our master's students that we're working with. Because you talked at the beginning about defining coaching as creating an environment for learning and it being about a learning conversation. And it would seem like if any of our conversations in an academic context are a, you know, learning conversation, it's that one. Can you unpack that a little bit for us from this lens of connection and care and what we can bring from coaching to it?
Yeah, yes. One of the books that's coming out pretty soon is actually called Coaching in Higher Education. And there's a chapter by Professor Katia Jinainati, which is actually about the supervisory relationship between a supervisor and a PhD student or a supervisor and a master's student. But before, I just want to share one of my professors, tell a little story about Professor George Ferrella, really a wonderful human being. And talk about caring. You know, if I had any doubts that an academic cared, I would tell you this little story. So I was studying at the American University of Beirut. I wasn't really sure what I wanted to study. So I had a degree that is possible in U.S. universities, or was possible back then. It was called majorless. So I was in university without a major, which meant that I had free choice. I could pick lots of different subjects. And I loved that. So I was taking philosophy and sociology and lots of topics. And I picked one on Shakespeare. And I was like, I don't know what that's all about, might like it. And then first day of class, I go into class. There is Professor Ferrella. He's standing by the desk in front of the room. And he's standing on one leg. And he had like these worry beads. They're kind of prayer beads. And those worry beads, he put them on his head. Later, I realized it's a bit like a crown, but he had them on his head. He was standing on one leg, and then he proceeded to deliver like a 40-minute lecture, standing on one leg the whole time. And all of us, it was the first lesson, so we're a bit embarrassed. We didn't know what to say. We were all thinking, what's going on here? What? Why on earth this person? And towards the end, he was talking about Hamlet and Shakespeare tragedies where there's this tension that builds up. And, you know, the release of the tension is the end of the play, or that's what he was trying to teach. And he did that by standing on one leg. And towards the end, he said, you were probably wondering. And he had me hooked from day one. And I hope that everybody listening to this can think of that professor, that support staff member, that academic, that careers advisor who made that significant difference to their life. Because I went on to study Shakespeare at university. That's why I went to England. It was that class. It was that academic. And, you know, one time, I'd never thought of studying Shakespeare, but one time, Professor Ferrella sat down with me. And he said, you know, you seem to really get Shakespeare. It seems to be something. It was one conversation that really transformed my life. It meant that I left Lebanon to go study a PhD. It meant that I got onto this journey. So I know all your listeners, or I hope they can think of somebody like that. But my message to everyone now is you can be that person. And the chances of that are high because interact with students and colleagues, especially in times like this. I think what people now need more than anything is undivided attention. If you can provide that for somebody else right now, that is so precious. So I think that's something we can all do now. But remember, in order to do that, we need to look after ourselves first. We need to make sure we have something to give. And even if you start off by making sure you've got 5% to give, that's okay. But if you're running at minus 5%, minus 20%, I would prioritize that. So I'm not saying, please go give people your undivided attention straight away. First, please make sure you've got whatever it is you need. And you know that. You can do an assessment yourself to say, how am I feeling? Do I feel valued? Do I feel I'm well? Do I feel I'm doing things that are meaningful in my life? So those are the first questions. And as soon as possible, transfer into giving other people that kind of undivided attention. And in the distracted world we have, people immediately realize it. And then it comes back to this idea of, do they leave interactions with you feeling seen, valued, and heard? So that would be the foundation, I would say.
Yeah.
And every interaction with every student is an opportunity to demonstrate that, whether it's a 10-minute conversation or a 2-hour conversation. I think it's possible to convey that. But the other thing I want to overlay, especially when we're talking about supervision, and this is what Professor Ishnanati's chapter is going to be about. I'm editing the books. I've had a chance to look at it. Is being intentional again about the role of the supervisor. And the suggestion there is moving from a kind of a teacher role into a mentoring role, into a coaching role, and gradually passing responsibility to the student. Because again, that's what universities are all about. It's about empowering people. It's about building their self, building their self-belief. But I do think a structure is helpful, because at the start, the student may need and is likely to need guidance, clarity, teaching, but I'm pretty sure they don't need that throughout the interaction.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's helpful for the student if we take an overly parental kind of approach managing their learning and growth.
Because just looking at another paper that you published, article published last year about ask more, tell less, how to structure learning conversations. And also in your work around coaching, you talk about different stances that we can take. And our mind is often, we wear our expert hat quite heavily and seriously. Yes. And we forget that sometimes we do need for creating, like this goes back to the intention, if we want to create a learning environment for the people that we're working with, we actually need to take off that expert hat sometimes. And your different stances, you talk about directive and facilitative and dialogic. And it struck me when I was reading that the facilitative and the dialogic, where we could develop a lot more expertise and spend more time. And as you said, depending upon where the student is at. Could you explain the difference in
there? I can. And thank you for this wonderful conversation, Geraldine. It's good for my well-being to talk about this, because it does give me hope. Because, these ideas, I think, could make a real difference. And the time we're in now. So this idea of holding tightly to expertise, well, the university context has created that. And we promote people based on their expertise. People, you move up the academic ladder, as it were, based on your expertise. You give lectures based on your expertise. So being in the role of expert is promoted by our institutions and rewarded, and probably rightly. But we have to bear in mind right now that AI is going to be playing a big part in the future. And a lot of the things that we valued as saying, you know what, when I pick my academics, I want to find the one who's got the most knowledge, the most expertise. It might be that we're entering a different era where the educator is more of a facilitator, somebody who facilitates learning. And coming back to this idea, maybe our academics are people who are skilled at creating ideal environments in which learning can take place. And maybe our university administrators are all experts in creating organizational systems that allow these things to happen. And you're right. And so I don't want to remove the directive element, because in the example I gave, if somebody's starting a PhD, by definition, they don't know what they need to know. And so the first part of it is likely to involve some transfer of expertise. So expertise is valuable. And you're right that the area for further consideration development are these two, facilitative and dialogical. And my involvement with the dialogical arena is more recent, because I was pretty committed to the facilitative approach. But the facilitative approach has its shortcomings as well, because the facilitative approach, the way I would understand it, is you don't share information, you don't add ideas, you're really just believing that the client has all of the answers. Now, sometimes they do. And there are times, especially in learning environments, where maybe they don't have the knowledge that's necessary in order to make the progress that they need. And so an example of this would be when a university professional is working with a university student talking about career options. This is where that example really, I think, fits. Sometimes, if we take a completely facilitative approach, it would involve the professional saying, well, what do you think you should do? What have you seen? What are your friends doing? What have you seen elsewhere? And the student may lack knowledge about what options there are, what career paths may be available, whether entrepreneurship is the right way. So they might be lacking knowledge. The option, which I think has been used in career advice, is probably also not helpful, because what's happening there is a matching of this is what you're good at, this is a career that needs what you're good at, but it's missing a big component of what fulfills you and what do you want to do. So that's where the dialogical approach, I think, fits nicely. And dialogical for me is a facilitative approach. In nature, it's facilitative, and it had this idea of dialogical, in which both people share ideas. Now, it's still not advice giving. It's still not telling people what to do. But in this example we've talked about, the professional might say, what sort of things can you imagine yourself doing in future? The person said, well, I think maybe engineering, maybe architecture. And the professional might say, oh, they're great ideas. Are you aware that there's these two new areas that are developing around that? But it's just adding to what is known without advising specifically. So I think there's huge scope there. And also, when we think about the peer support that academics and leaders in universities can provide to one another, imagine that academics across different universities, across different sectors, providing that kind of peer support, which could be dialogical. I think there's a lot of opportunity there. But Geraldine, bear in mind, I do have an interest in all of this. I do think coaching has an important role to play in education more broadly. So I'm coming from one angle. And a lot of these ideas probably begin to bump into the realities of the way universities are set up. So don't want to be seen to be saying there's any easy answers. In fact, I think there are not. Yeah. And I think the challenge has been that we're looking for quick fixes, some kind of new structure that'll fix everything. I'm saying it's probably complex, and it probably involves working at a very human level. And therefore, I think coaching or other ways of thinking about how do human beings interact with one another is part of the solution.
Yes, it's that connection piece again, which is what we're fundamentally about. That's the foundation. Well, the connection is the foundation, building on the foundation of who we are and how we show up and our well-being. I'm just reflecting on when I first trained as a coach back in 2007, it totally transformed how I interacted with my students in that I felt like I was responsible for their success and that I had to also have tighter control over what happened. And I think one of the mindset shifts for me that made a big difference was some of the stuff that you talked about, the encouraging the autonomy, the seeing people and valuing people for who they are and not that I'm making little mini me's.
And how did that work out?
Amazingly. You know, I could feel the pressure. I literally felt the pressure off my shoulders because it was, we were in it together. And I still always struggle with that dance of when it's a good moment to bring in the expertise and how to do it. And your piece around the intentionality just is something I want to keep reconnecting with because it reminds me about what's my intention here in sharing this. Because I think sometimes, especially when I'm not looking after my own well-being or I'm really busy, my intention subconsciously, I wouldn't articulate it like this, but is the quickest solution possible so I can get on because I'm busy. And so I think that piece, a lot of what you've talked about is the value of being reflective about your own practices, whether it's about your energy levels, what lights you up, what you care about, what your choices are.
Yes, exactly, Geraldine. And, you know, for students and academics alike, the realization that it is a bit of a dance, Geraldine. There's a dance between those. Academics get energy from their students. Students get energy from their academics. It is that I know the feeling of going into a lecture hall and seven students have turned up out of a possible 100. And it's because now it's recorded or whatever, but we have to think through the implication. What is the well-being impact for an academic who's thinking, I've done all this preparation, and then only seven people show up. So that has an impact on the academic. They're likely to reduce their investment in these kind of interactions. And equally, if a lot of students show up and the academic hasn't done any preparation, just goes through the slides because they're thinking, I just need to get on to the next thing. So I would say it's mutually beneficial and it's really allowing us each to be at our best. It's this idea of allowing people to be in their sweet spots. If you're a student, your sweet spot is being curious, it's being engaged, asking lots of questions. If you're an academic, it's being available, being interested, being engaged. And little things can change that dynamic between I'm the expert and they're the recipients of the expertise. That's no longer a very, I think, effective and engaging model of education. And it is, like you said, the pressure off of our shoulders. If I'm standing in a room with 100 people and I think, oh, I have to have the answer to everything, I'm going to be anxious. I'm going to be pretty rigid. I'm not going to go far off of my content. Whereas if we've got this sense of, look, we're all here to learn. And as an academic, I often say, oh, I hadn't thought about that, or I don't know the answer to that. Role modeling this idea of we're learning together and we can find out. So I do think that stance idea is important. And again, it's something we can all think about immediately. And it's to do with interaction. Say, well, in this interaction, what's going to be the most helpful stance? And in that book, Radical Listening, we refer back to some research from the, I think it's the 1980s, around optimal matching. Again, there's research to support these ideas in the sense that optimal matching is to saying that if the support required and the support provided match, then you get good outcomes. It sounds pretty obvious, but I'll give you an example. If a colleague comes to you and they're overwhelmed with their work, or a student comes to you and they're overwhelmed with the amount of assignments, and you assume what they want is the answer, and you get into directive mode, maybe that's not what's wanted. So that could be suboptimal matching, but you're still thinking, oh yeah, I'm just going to tell them what to do. Organize it like this, do this assignment first, then do that. If that's what had been wanted, if the student had come along saying, I need your help to categorize these things, great. So it's, I think we can already be working hard to make sure, is what's wanted a solution, or is what's wanted to be listened to, or a sign of compassion? And I've started now advocating for greater clarity about that. Let's not try and use our intuition or pick up tiny signals. Why don't we ask somebody? One of the first interactions could be, what's going to be most helpful for you right now? And that already shows that I'm interested in providing the right kind of support. And sometimes I say, look, Christian, I just need a listening ear. I just need to offload something. Great. Now I know how I can be helpful. Whereas I might have automatically gone into problem-solving mode, which would have caused, you know, possible tension in the conversation. We can all do these things, but you're right, Geraldine. It does come back to intention, positive intention. And wouldn't it be great if we can shift the intention, like you said? I do think this happens subconsciously a lot for a lot of us. Somehow the intention becomes, I just need to get through this day. My intention is somehow to make it through this day.
To survive.
I don't want to be on the other side of that. You know, maybe this is the big question that's emerging from our conversation is, how can we shift that intention from, I just want to survive, or I just want to make it through this day, to my intention is to add value. My intention is to be the best educator I can be. My intention is to be the best learner I can be. And what needs to happen so that I can genuinely have that intention? Because I do want to clarify, as we're talking, this isn't about affirmations. I'm not talking about making an affirmation to say, I am going to have a great day or something like that. Because that can be like, I'm trying to convince myself of something. This is more about having that quite reflective time to think about, what is it that I would want for myself and others? What do I really want for myself and others? And if my intention is I need to just survive this day, then I have to do things in my life to reduce what I'm expected to do in any given day so that I can take a different stance. You know, so one of the risks with the positive psychology movement is that it can look like we're offering band-aid type solutions to really systemic issues, right? So if you're working in a university where people are overworked and there's significant pressure on staff and on students, short half-day sessions about well-being are not the answer. It's really going back and saying systemically what needs to happen. Until that happens, Geraldine, my message to listeners is we all have agency. All have choices. And if for some of our listeners, and I suspect this is the case, if for some of our listeners it feels self-indulgent to say, I'm going to prioritize my own well-being, I hope it isn't, but I suspect it might be. Well, do it for your learners. Do it for your colleagues. Say, I'm going to look after my own well-being so that I can be present and engage for others.
And the presence and engagement with others, the seeing others, the connecting, the deep listening, the radical listening that you talk about, and you talked about the role of curiosity and questions as part of listening in all of that as well. It needs us to be present to be able to really do those sorts of things.
That's another good self-check is, how present are we? That's a great thing. And Geraldine, I'm talking as somebody who was almost never present because my mind's usually racing. I think people listening will notice I do jump around a little bit. But before I trained to become a coach, I was never in the present moment. And if somebody had told me, be present, I would have said, what are you talking about? I don't even understand what you're talking about. Because, for example, in this podcast, I'd already be thinking about, well, what's my next thing? When is that going to start? What should I do? And I spent my whole professional life in the future. I was never present and I wouldn't have known how to do that. But then when I started training to become a coach, I realized, like you said, Jeremy, I thought, you know what? This isn't respectful to my client. I'm sitting here and I'm thinking about something else. I need to be here. And so I had to practice becoming present. And the way I did that was being intentional And there was a commute that I would do every day. This was in the pre-pandemic days where I would actually go to work. And I'd walk. There was a walk between the car park and my office location, which was about 12 minutes. And Geraldine, I honestly couldn't have described it to you. I didn't know what it was because it was just that little bit between the car park and my work. And my mind was already processing, planning, whatever. And I thought, you know, those 12 minutes, let me see if I can just be fully present for them. And it was a very hard but gradual journey. And I discovered what a beautiful walk it was. It's a real place. It's a town called Warwick. If anybody's been to Warwick in the United Kingdom, it's a beautiful town. And I realized there's beautiful trees. There's houses that are stunning all along the route. And I started noticing the leaves will be different colors. And so I practiced. And then I realized, wow, this feels great to be not thinking about anything else. I'm right here. I'm on the sidewalk. Somebody suggested this idea of even noticing the weeds that grow in the cracks of the sidewalk. And I did start noticing those things. And so this idea of noticing more what's happening now is a way of being more present, directing our noticing to what's around me right now. It takes the energy away from being able to think about future things. So yeah. I just wanted to say to our listeners that I had to practice being in the present moment, and it's a beautiful feeling. And of course, I was able to transfer that into important personal relationships in my life, friendships, but also professional relationships. And now I'm so grateful I learned how to be present, and other ways that might suit other people are mindfulness activities are usually a good way. There's apps out there that help you. And so if you're thinking, what is Christian talking about? But I've been there, and please find out. And if you're already good at being in the moment, how can we bring that more into our professional interactions? Yeah. Are some good things just to be reflecting on, perhaps.
And noticing, again, is a lovely part of your radical listening framework as well. So, yeah, that's a lovely practical piece of advice to finish on. I'm so grateful for your time and your generosity in sharing this, and so much to think about. Thank you very much, Christian.
Well, thank you, Geraldine. And just as a final note, this has been joyful effort, Geraldine, for both of us. So if listeners are thinking about joyful effort, well, this is it. You know, we're talking about important things. This is work. This can have a big impact professionally. This can impact serious things. And it's been a joy. And that's because of your wonderful listening, Geraldine. Thank you so much. You're a great practitioner of radical listening, because I feel seen, valued, and heard. I have no doubt that you were interested. You asked such thoughtful questions. So thank you so much, Geraldine.
Thank you, Christian. So many calls for action there, and lots of really practical suggestions for how we can be academic rebels in where we are right now. What can you do to bring joy back to your work, to your teams, to your groups, to working with your students in the classroom? So just a reminder, he made lots of suggestions, like reflecting on why we got into this in the first place, like reflecting on our calendars for what's given us a sense of meaning and purpose in our work, and where do we see our energy lying, about how we prioritize our well-being, about asking people who come to us what would be most helpful for you right now, rather than just jumping in with advice first up. And reflecting upon being more deliberate and intentional in how we show up in our everyday interactions. So much to take away. Can I encourage you then to think about what could be the one thing that you want to start experimenting with now? How can you be part of bringing more joy to your work, for yourself and for others? These are the small practical ways that we can be academic rebels and our small choices can make a big difference.
You can find the summary notes, a transcript and related links for this podcast on www.changingacademiclife.com. You can also subscribe to Changing Academic Life on iTunes, Spotify, and I'm really hoping that we can widen the conversation about how we can do academia differently. And you can contribute to this by rating the podcast and also giving feedback. And if something connected with you, please consider sharing this podcast with your colleagues. Together, we can make change happen.